Today is Wednesday, November 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump is ramping up as new information emerges and Democrats enter a new phase. Iran retaliates against a media organization that uncovered violent attacks on government protesters.
But as the government is forced to choose between guns and butter, every time it chooses guns, it risks opening itself up to more pressure. And that's exactly what we just saw here.
Also ahead, singer-songwriter Cyndi Lauper is about to get a very prestigious award from the United Nations. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump's dealings with Ukraine and the withholding of U.S. foreign aid for what accusers say was in exchange for an investigation into his Democratic presidential rival Joe Biden to take on Trump in 2020, that is entering a new phase. But the president's supporters continue to promote what has been a debunked accusation of Ukraine, not Russia, meddling in the 2016 U.S. election. That theory now has the support of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who says many countries and foreign political groups were found to be meddling in that election.
Whatever nation it is, that we have information that so much as suggests that there might have been interference or an effort to interfere in our elections, we have an obligation to make sure that the American people get to go to the ballot box, cast their ballots in a way that is unimpacted by these malevolent actors trying to undermine our Western democratic values.
The House Judiciary Committee, meanwhile, is set to take over the impeachment probe of President Donald Trump next week, scheduling a December 4th hearing on the question of high crimes and misdemeanors set in the Constitution. And joining us now live to talk more about all of these next steps in this impeachment investigation is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be with you again.
All right, so we've got these hearings coming up next week. How is this different, and would you say this is basically getting more real for the president?
Oh, no question about that. I mean, when we look at what's happening now, you think about what the Intelligence Committee was doing. They were really acquiring facts. They're trying to understand what was going on, what it meant. If you think back to what happened with Bill Clinton several decades ago, what you think of was the Starr Report, where they came out and said, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. It was about acquiring what happened. But when you actually take it to the Judiciary Committee, what you're going to see is something different. You'll see a combination of a lot of that information, but it's also about having people come in and say, what are the standards here? What is the law here? And exactly what things should we be looking at, and what, if you will, high crimes and misdemeanors were actually violated in this case. So they're going to start talking about that. That's the idea of drafting articles of impeachment, which you ultimately take to the U.S. Senate.
It's interesting because through the entire hearing process within the intelligence community, Republicans and the president just continued to claim that it wasn't a fair process. But we do understand now that Democrats have offered the president an opportunity to testify in these upcoming hearings and tell his side of the story. Trump and his lawyers have been invited to attend the hearings and even make a request to question witnesses. Will he continue to accuse them of being unfair? Will he have any argument? And how likely is it that he would actually follow up and be willing to testify?
Well, of course he's going to continue to claim that this is unfair. Of course he's going to claim that this is a witch hunt. This is what he has done from the beginning in this case. If you look at what the Republicans and what the president have done is they started out complaining about process. So in other words, this was an internal investigation to determine if there was issues. And then what the Democrats did is they opened it up and they said, fine, you want an open hearing? Let's have an open hearing. And then what you saw was a pivot from the White House and from his supporters that said, no, it's not just about that. It's about something else. And they continued to pivot along the way. So the idea that that's going to change now is not. They're not talking about the facts and the objective information that was provided during the inquiry itself. What they will continue to talk about is process and likely even conclude based upon that well, there was nothing done that would reach the level of an impeachment. You're going to see that coming.
So after this next these judiciary hearings, then it goes to the Senate. Is that what I'm understanding from you?
Yes, yeah, that's what we're going to see. Although you have to remember, though, there's some other interesting things that are going on right now. There's still an impeachment investigation taking place. There were just some information that's come out recently about two OMB pretty senior officials who came out and actually resigned as a result of this, watching what was going on. And there was a recent federal court decision that has implications that direct this completely, because we have to remember the president basically muzzled a whole series of people who are relevant to the investigation. We found that Ambassador Sondland mentioned during the investigation itself that everybody was in the loop. So we're talking about Pence, the vice president, Pompeo, the secretary of state, Perry, secretary of energy, Mulvaney, chief of staff, and Bolton. And the list goes on and on that the president muzzled, saying that they do not have to testify. We have the ability to shut this down. And we saw a shift that talked about Mulvaney specifically that said, you can't do that. So that has massive implications about forcing these people to potentially testify about what they know and what they think they heard.
Right. The judge in this, I don't know if you call it a ruling or a... What, is it a ruling? What would that be?
Well, essentially it was, because it was a lawsuit. So,
okay.
So what you had was you had a judicial finding in a case like this where federal judge Brown Jackson basically ordered that Don McGahn, his former White House counsel, is obligated to testify. This actually goes back to the Mueller case, but what makes it important is that the president tried to make an argument that all of these people have blanket immunity and they are not obligated to testify. And what was really astounding is this federal judge came out and said something that I rarely see. And what you saw was something that said, presidents are not kings. They work for the people, and they work for the people of the United States. They take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, not the president. And that is a massive shift, because what it does is not just open up what McGahn can say. Again, it opens up what the vice president has the potential to say, what Pompeo says, what Perry says, Mulvaney. The list goes on and on and on. And that's what it sort of throws the wild card in here. We know some things, but we don't know everything.
Lastly, how unprecedented. Have you ever heard a judge speak like that to a president of the United States, saying president is not king?
You know, you have to go back and look at what we saw, especially under Nixon, where Nixon tried to make similar arguments, but rarely have you seen anything like this. And actually what I found particularly pleasing is that there is a constitutional obligation for Congress to provide oversight. And oversight is of the president when it comes to certain issues. And the only way for them to do it is to be able to talk to people. If a sitting president has the ability to shut down everybody in the room, then it's literally impossible for Congress to actually fulfill their obligation. And that's the conclusion. And when you get the strength that says presidents are not kings, that is an extraordinary statement. We live in really amazing times.
All right. Well, we always appreciate your perspective. That is criminal defense attorney and former CIA officer Jack Rice. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
International climate experts warned on Tuesday that global temperatures could rise sharply this century with wide-ranging and destructive consequences after greenhouse gas emissions hit record levels last year. The head of the World Meteorological Organization said global temperatures could rise by 3 to 5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels this century, more than three times agreed limits if nothing is done to stop rising emissions. A summary by the UN Environment Program said the expected rise in temperatures will bring wide-ranging and very destructive impacts. VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson talked about the report with Rachel Cletus, policy director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists.
This report from the United Nations Environment Program basically is a huge alarm bell for the world, because what it shows is that despite pledges that were made in Paris in 2015, we're still far off track from where we need to be in terms of bending the global emissions curve to help limit the global temperature increase to no more than 1.5 C. So in fact, we're on track for 3.2 C at the current rate of emissions and the promises that countries have made so far in terms of cutting them. And that is truly catastrophic, because we will start to see the kind of climate impacts worsen that we're already seeing around the world, whether it's heat waves, floods, wildfires. Climate change is already here. We're already seeing these kinds of impacts both in the U.S. and around the world. And our failure to cut emissions is putting us at grave risk of much worse impacts to come.
What does the Union of Concerned Scientists recommending governments do in terms of policy, and what do ordinary citizens do?
Well, if you take a look at this UN report that was just released, what it points out is that we have to make some pretty sharp cuts in emissions over the next 10 years to stay on track to limit some of the worst climate impacts. It's talking about cutting emissions on the order of over 7% per year over the next decade. What that means is we have to act economy-wide to cut emissions. We have to ramp up energy efficiency, make sure we're switching to low-carbon forms of electricity, wind, solar, other low-carbon electricity. We have to make sure to electrify as much of the economy as possible. So electric vehicles and the transportation sector, electrify industrial use of energy, basically look across the economy for energy efficiency and electrification opportunities. And at the same time, we've got to make sure that we're safeguarding the so-called land sink, our soils and forests that help store carbon, not just safeguard them, but also enhance their ability to store carbon. Basically, across the economy, deep, ambitious action to cut emissions and store more carbon. And we've got to invest in R&D for the next generation of technologies that will help us continue to cut these emissions through 2050 and beyond. We have to aim for net zero emissions by 2050, essentially, and get started right away.
By land sinks, I want to clarify for the audience what you're talking about would be such areas as old growth forests, the Amazon, and then also peat bogs and that sort of turf.
Yeah, we have the opportunity right now already. We're having around the world, we have carbon that's being stored in forests, in soils, and this is a huge help towards helping to meet our global climate goals. What we've got to do is make sure that we're continuing to invest in agricultural practices, forest management practices, and other ways to conserve this so-called land sink that is storing carbon. Unfortunately, right now, there are many practices that are degrading our soils. We're having forests set on fire that burn and are releasing those carbon emissions. So we're going in the opposite direction from where we need to be.
We have the climate summit coming up in a couple of weeks in Madrid. How does this report affect the dialogue and the debate that will be going on in Madrid?
At COP25, I think what will be paramount on people's minds is how are we going to live up to the commitments that nations made under the Paris Agreement? Because we're clearly off track right now in terms of cutting emissions. And the consequences have been dire, especially for some of the least developed countries around the world that are facing a really harmful, damaging climate impacts right now. So the issues that will be on the table will include, how can countries ratchet up their ambition to commit to more serious emission reductions in the time frames and on the scale that we need? How can countries help least developed countries also make this transition to a low-carbon pathway and cope with the consequences of climate change? This issue is going to be particularly acute and is going to be brought up by a number of nations that are really facing dire consequences and want help in terms of helping their populations cope. They're facing food and water crises, sea level rise threatening flooding in coastal areas. Marine ecosystems are being destroyed by ocean acidification and warming oceans. So there's really a dire need to cut emissions and also build resilience towards the impacts that unfortunately are already here and are worsening.
Some of those issues on impacts, they disproportionately affect the developing world, but there are also some major impacts in the developing developed world. We have in Europe, in the United States, in Canada, Australia, Japan, most of the major cities are close to water. A lot of them are low level. How are the big countries going to be able to deal with their own issues and at the same time go to Bangladesh and say, okay, here's what we're going to need to help keep Dhaka, one of the most crowded cities in the world, from being completely overwhelmed?
There's no question that climate change affects every single country around the world. Here in the U.S., for example, just this year, we've seen record-breaking floods in the Midwest and all along the Mississippi. We've seen these catastrophic wildfires in California. We've seen these really intense hurricanes and heavy rainfall events this year with Hurricane Dorian, in previous years, Maria, Harvey, Florence. So this is a crisis that is already upon us here in the U.S. and around the world as well. And that's why the opportunity we have here is to work together for our global common destiny. And this is what young people around the world are urging their political leaders to do, because this crisis is about their futures, most importantly. So the opportunity we have here is to see that global common destiny and act together to cut emissions and help people cope with these impacts that are unfolding. And that's what we will be urging at COP25 in Madrid. What's lacking here is really political will. We have the technologies to cut emissions. We know where some of these climate impacts are unfolding and the kinds of measures we can invest in to build resilience to help protect people and their health. What we need are political leaders that will stand up and do the right thing in the time frame that's necessary. That's what's missing.
All right, that's Rachel Cletus, Policy Director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. UN investigators are working to prosecute Islamic State terrorists. Canadian Jews have joined Iranian diaspora rallies in solidarity with Iran protesters. Thousands of Palestinians are protesting a change in U.S. policy on Jewish settlements. And President Trump signs an order to probe unsolved cases of missing Native Americans. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Iran has imposed punitive measures on individuals associated with the London-based TV channel that aired videos of anti-government protests. The judiciary's website said it imposed judicial and legal restrictions on property held by individuals associated with Iran International, but they did not elaborate. The channel is believed to be linked to Saudi Arabia, which Iran has accused them and Western nations of fomenting the unrest. The Persian language channel also aired several videos of the anti-government protests that erupted across Iran last week in response to a fuel price hike. Amnesty International says at least 143 people were killed and that security forces fired on unarmed protesters. Joining us to talk more about all of what is happening there with the unrest is Iran expert Behnam Bentaleblou of the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Thank you so much for being with us, sir. So what's your reaction to the chaos we're seeing and hearing about?
I think the first thing is that, you know, Washington is used to a certain pace and tone and tenor of protest in the Islamic Republic. But really what we've seen since late 2017 is a constant uptick in the number of Iranian protests, the scale and the scope of these protests. Really, for the past 3 years, we've had lots of protests in Iran, drastically reducing the time from about a decade to just a matter of months. And these protests, like the ones in 2017/2018, had an economic flashpoint, but really tapped into a bunch of larger political grievances that really prove why the Islamic Republic of Iran as a government is revolutionary, but the citizenry of the Islamic Republic are post-revolutionary. There's this long-standing chasm between state and society, and that chasm was borne out again with people continuing to chant for the past few days while the internet was cut off and just a few days before that. Not Gaza, not Lebanon, my life for Iran, really the same kind of nationalist chant that you've been hearing in Iran for a decade now. Mm. And while lots of these powerful videos did come out in the first few days, getting confirmable videos once the internet was cut became measurably more challenging. And ultimately, the regime used the cover of darkness to crack down. And it's believed that this most recent batch of protests have been the most violent by the regime, more violent than 2017-18, more violent than 2009, more violent than 1999, more violent than 1994-95. The regime now knows it has to crack skulls. It's under pressure from abroad, from the United States, from the sanctions, pressure in the region, Iraq and Lebanon. Shiites are up in arms about Iran's overextended influence in the Arab world. And at home, there's a social bubbling of pressure against the regime. So the regime acted quickly, decisively, and with more brute force than we've seen ever before.
And the protesters, they're upset over rising gas prices, but it goes deeper than that. The crushing sanctions from the U.S., they're seeing savings dwindle, jobs becoming more scarce. So it's definitely impacting Iran's 80 million people. Is that not correct?
The macroeconomic pressure that the U.S. has put on Iran for the past year now. You know, remember, the sanctions were restored last November. In this one-year period, U.S. unilateral sanctions have actually been more effective to Iran's bottom line, budgets, and revenues than the past decade of multilateral sanctions, which is really an impressive phenomenon for peaceful U.S. tools of coercion and punishment and deterrence. Something that many in Washington did not even think could happen if the U.S., quote-unquote, went it alone, and ultimately it did. But inside Iran, one of the most fascinating domestic dynamics to watch is, as this pressure mounts, as this pressure aggregates, the Iranian people are using the same nationalist slogans, and they're also pointing a finger still at the peak of U.S. pressure at the regime, at Khamenei, chanting, you know, transgressing red lines by saying death to the dictator. In one city, they actually burned a statue of Khomeini, the founding father of the revolution, his Shiite ring, you know, proving that this goes more than just past politics or economics. This goes through the Iranian people have a fundamentally different vision of what kind of country they have. And it torpedoes the thesis that with foreign pressure, the people will rally around the flag. This proves that given any crisis, religious, social, political, and most definitely economic, the people will want to accentuate the chasm that exists between them and the state. So really, there's been a lot of remaking about assumptions and thoughts about Iran that Washington has held kind of sacred for more than a decade in a bipartisan fashion.
Should the U.S. care that the people that are hurting the most are the citizens of Iran and not the government as much?
Well, as the government is forced to choose between guns and butter, every time it chooses guns, it risks opening itself up to more pressure. And that's exactly what we just saw here. You know, because of budget issues, the Rouhani administration in Iran, really goaded by the supreme leader who had been talking about this thing called the resistance economy since at least 2009 or at least 2014, was looking to shift Iran's reliance on oil exports to Iran's non-oil sector, as well as get the Iranian people, which use subsidized gasoline at the pump, to buy much less. And they really forced this decision through that basically raised these gas prices significantly overnight about a week and a half ago. And when the Iranian people woke up the next morning, they saw these drastically high prices at the pump. And some of the initial pictures we got out of Tehran, and it's a picture of a guy who parked his car in protest, and that's how the protest really began. And it says, "I'm not an American, I'm not against the revolution, but my back has broken against all this pressure and the lack of care of the central government." And that fundamental feeling of being an alien in your own country is how the 1979 revolution happened, at least socially and intellectually, and could lay the predicate for something much larger. So the U.S. needs to care, because this is one of those few areas in the Middle East where you have a confluent or a marriage of your ideals and your interests. Seldom in the sands of the Middle East do you get to have this opportunity.
All right, Ben. I'm Ben Talablu of the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. We appreciate your perspective. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, the holiday season officially began at the White House Monday as First Lady Melania Trump received the 2019 White House Christmas tree. Unlike last year, President Donald Trump did not attend the tree presentation. The tree arrived by jingle bell-adorned horse and carriage, continuing an annual White House tradition to highlight the holiday spirit. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara has more.
The White House holiday season is here. On Monday, First Lady Melania Trump received the official Christmas tree. The tree arrived by carriage, drawn by horses named Cash and Ben, continuing an annual tradition.
Just a few decades earlier, they were still sort of delivering the tree in like pickup trucks. So it's nice that they make it a little bit more festive to do it with a Christmas-themed sled and a drawn carriage.
This year's tree is a 5.6 meters tall Douglas fir, winner of the National Christmas Tree Association's Christmas Tree Contest, planted by Larry Snyder of Mahantongo Valley Farms in Pennsylvania. The association have presented the official White House Christmas tree every year since 1966 to be displayed in the Blue Room.
Betty Ford, dressed in a Christmas smock made by a friend, put old-fashioned ornaments that she and daughter Susan made on the 18-foot fir tree in the Blue Room. Every decoration on the state floor of the White House was made by hand to reflect a typical children's Christmas 100 years ago.
The tree is a central part of the holiday decor with a theme selected by the First Lady, a tradition started by Jacqueline Kennedy in 1961 when she decorated her tree with ornaments modeled after the Nutcracker Ballet.
Oftentimes it has different patriotic themes, holiday themes, family themes, and it tells you a little bit more about, I think, the President and First Lady who are living there, the types of themes they pick. And what they see as it's important to have this representation on the traditional Blue Room Christmas tree.
Last year, Melania Trump was ridiculed by some for her choice of red trees. What theme will she choose this year? We will find out when the White House unveils the 2019 holiday theme in early December. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, White House.
Singer Cyndi Lauper will be presented with an inaugural award, the High Note Global Prize Award, for her advocacy for the LGBTQ community. She received the award on December 10th during a benefit concert that she puts on in Los Angeles, and it's a date that coincides with Human Rights Day. Singer Kesha will be presenting Lauper with the award. The prize, presented by the UN Human Rights and High Note Global Initiative, was created by philanthropist David Clark in an effort to honor artists working to promote human rights. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for listening, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
This world makes you crazy. You take it all you can get. You call me up because you know I'll be there, and I see your true colors shining through. I see your true colors, and that's why I love you. So don't be afraid to let it show your true. True colors, true colors, true.
This is VOA.